This week on New York Now, a conversation with the new head of the New York State Bar Association.
The relatively smaller salaries that doctors would be paid or lawyers would be paid in these upstate communities, coupled with the debt, is a toxic combination and a disincentive for them to make their lives and careers in those communities.
And John Campbell of the USA Today Network joins us to analyze the week's news.
The governor put this out and has really spent the last week plus trying to explain it. Lawmakers across the state have been having events denouncing the fee, the mandatory nature of having to turn in your place after 10 years, whether or not they are of good quality or not.
It's next on New York Now, right here on PBS.
Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET. Winner of a New York State Emmy for Best Political Program, this is New York Now.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to New York Now. I'm Matt Ryan.
And I'm Casey Seiler from the Times Union. At the start of the week, three New Yorkers were running for president. After Wednesday, though, we are down to two.
Hey, everyone. I wanted you to hear it from me first, that after more than eight incredible months, I'm ending my presidential campaign. I know this isn't the result we wanted. We wanted to win this race. But it's important to know when it's not your time and to know how you can best serve your community and country. I believe I can best serve by helping to unite us to beat Donald Trump in 2020.
Rensselaer County's Kirsten Gillibrand dropped out this week after failing to qualify for next month's Democratic primary debate. The senator was unable to hit the threshold of 2% in four DNC-approved polls, nor was she able to attract the required 130,000 individual donor benchmark. She told us last month in New Hampshire she would continue on campaigning even if she didn't qualify for the upcoming debates, but obviously changed her mind when she failed to gain any momentum in the last month.
This leaves just New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio and tech executive Andrew Yang as the only New Yorkers left in the race. Yang has qualified for the debate in Houston next month. The latest polls have him around 3%. That's 2 points up from de Blasio, who was hovering around 1%. All right, and now for some analysis of the week's news. We're happy to be joined at the table by John Campbell of the USA Today Network. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So we just saw Kirsten Gillibrand bowing out, really failed to take fire in any appreciable way. In the final poll, she was down in really the low single digits.
Yeah, well, even lower than that. You saw a dash in that campaign.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah, she needed to get four polls of 2% or better. And have 130,000 donors to get on the debate stage next month in Houston. She did not get that. And she used that as an opportunity to bow out. She viewed it as a fatal blow, really, that mm-hmm. she couldn't get on that debate stage. And you know, that is significant. I mean, that is a national stage. She was on the debate stage for the first two, as was Bill de Blasio, as was a handful of other candidates that aren't going to make it to the next round. But she, you know, she kind of realized that there wasn't a path forward for her, and she issued a video stepping down.
I think some people at the DNC are hoping that more people see the lights, the people who aren't making the debate stage. You know, it's time to move on. But I don't think anybody saw her, you know, not making, you know, being in the hash marks and 1% at this point when she came out in Troy, New York, come January. She was a pretty well-known figure, especially during the Me Too movement.
And I think the fundraising part of it is very interesting, too, because as a New York senator, she has been a very formidable fundraiser. Mm-hmm. But that stage is so crowded.
Yeah.
I mean, two dozen candidates. For the Democratic nomination, it was very difficult to break through. And you saw other folks like Pete Buttigieg and Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris, they've really ascended to that top tier. Mm-hmm. Gillibrand never got anywhere close.
In the final weeks, she was offering for a $1 mm-hmm. donation to try and get mm-hmm. to that the 130,000 number of donations. She was offering for a $1 donation a T-shirt that elsewhere on her website she was selling for $30,
which is
expensive.
Well, and the idea was to get more individual donors so you could get to that 130,000 donor threshold,
right.
But she didn't get there.
We also want to talk about the ongoing war over license plates. In particular, the governor's proposal that was just kind of slipped in to a press release that would require people with license plates that are 10 years or older that they'd have to get new plates that would cost $25.
Yeah, and you know, nothing riles up New York drivers more than license plate fees and throughway tolls. Mm-hmm.
And this combined both.
And, you know, the governor says, well, we need new license plates because we have these cashless tolling, this cashless tolling operation that's going to go throughway wide in 2020, where they capture a photo of your license plate and send you a bill. But then, you know, the idea now, there is cashless tolling on the Tappan Zee Bridge and in some areas downstate, and they do a great job capturing license plates as it is. So, you know, the governor put this out and has really spent the last week plus trying to explain it. Lawmakers across the state have been having events denouncing the fee, the mandatory nature of having to turn in your plates after 10 years, whether or not they are of good quality or not. And having to pay that $25. And then there's this other part of it where, you know, the governor keeps saying, you know, state law, lawmakers approved this in 2009, this $25 fee, but the law clearly says the fee is not to exceed $25. So he's trying to point the finger at the legislature. The legislature's pointing the finger at the governor, and it's really a mess.
Just to make that clear, DMV and the governor could charge $1.50 $24.99, whatever, any fee that's less than, or that's $25 or less. Yeah. They do not need the legislature to come back and do anything.
And they've offered no explanation for why they say we support lowering the fee, but they don't just do it. That being said, the DMV Commissioner Mark Schroeder issued a statement last night, you know, essentially daring the legislature to act on it, but also tucked into that, essentially said, hey, we're open to rolling this back. It doesn't take effect until April. Let's talk.
As Politico's Bill Mahoney told us last week, this is just you know, manna from heaven for GOP folks in the Assembly and in the Senate.
There was big news on the energy front. The federal government has cleared the way for construction of the Constitution Pipeline, a natural gas avenue that would run through the southern tier to Schoharie County, just west of us.
Yeah, and this is a really fascinating one because the courts had essentially upheld the state's right to not issue a water quality permit, which wouldn't allow this pipeline, which is bringing fracked gas from Pennsylvania into New York, where fracking is banned. They didn't issue a water quality permit in 2016. That really derailed the project. The company behind it, Williams, went to FERC, which is the federal regulator that oversees pipelines, and appealed to them. And they ruled that the state didn't act quickly enough on that permit request, so they essentially waived their right to issue a permit at all. That is a huge win for the Constitution Pipeline. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it will be challenged, but as of now, it clears the way for that pipeline to go forward in New York.
So moving from this to a slightly less weighty topic, John, you sat down with the governor on the train out to Syracuse in the state fair and talked about what has become known as the summer of Andrew, the governor living really his best life right here in the Capital Region elsewhere.
We spoke about, what interested me in this is he's lived in Westchester County for the better part of two decades. His partner, Sandra Lee, the celebrity chef and television personality, is selling that home. So he has been living nearly full time these days in Albany at the Executive Mansion. That has coincided with what people on social media have called the Summer of Andrew, which is a Seinfeld reference, where he's posted photos of himself water skiing and playing basketball and riding his motorcycle and riding his muscle cars with his dog in the back. So anyway, I did speak to him about that. He spoke very highly of Albany, and he spoke of kind of his routine, and you know, he's fixing up another Corvette, which is a very Andrew Cuomo thing to do. And he spoke of all sorts of things. His dog, he's been spotted walking his dog along Empire State Plaza, often without a state police detail, which kind of surprised me. But when I asked him that, he said, well, I'm not incarcerated. We spoke about his routine up here in Albany and how he's really become the first governor since his father to live essentially full-time in the mansion these days.
We get his public schedule, right, every day since 2011, and to see it in Albany anytime past, you know, June 25th, I mean, it was pretty rare during these last 8 years. Yeah. And so I did find it interesting, John, in your article you had the shot of him, you know, shooting basketball, but some kind of random shots of him, like on the Northway I-87, in his car with his dog. people actually recognizing him out in the wild.
He doesn't, you know, when you're in a Pontiac GTO, a 1968 Pontiac GTO with the top down, with your wolf-like dog in the backseat, right. And your license plate is literally the number one, right. People are going to notice.
Yeah, that's right.
Nice. Thanks for bringing it back around to license plates again. John, you got a gift from the governor, a 9.6-pound baloney, because you have called out, you have compiled every time the governor has used the expression baloney for BS, essentially.
And it's dozens of times. And I mean, this was 8 months ago. I put together a video, just a montage of all the times of him saying baloney, and it was 40-something times I was able to find.
Just go to word.
Way more since then. There's a lesson here, though, in that Andrew Cuomo won't let anyone have the last laugh, even if the first laugh was a silly baloney video 8 months ago.
We want to point out that you donated that to a local food bank. You're a good man. John Campbell of the USA Today Network, thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
This week's New York Now poll question asks, do you support the state's decision to replace the current license plates? I have a feeling we'll get a lot of votes on this one. Let us know at nynow.org. Coming off our interview with new GOP chair Nick Langworthy, we asked you how you thought New York Republicans would fare in 2020. Three quarters told us they thought they would do well. A lot of out-of-staters voting this week, so we'll just show you a few from New York. Sarah in the capital city said, as long as the Republicans continue to support Trump's policies and not what is best for this nation, how can anyone run the risk of supporting any Republican? Sean in Hicksville, watching on WLIW, is confident in the GOP's hope, saying, I think they will ride Trump's coattails to victory.
And finally, Cheryl in Schenectady County told us, the GOP has turned itself into a party of hate and division. I'm a lifelong independent, and I can't see myself ever voting Republican again.
Thank you to all those who reached out to us. You can vote on this week's question again at nynow.org. It's where we house all of our past programs and where you'll find links to us on social media, including Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
There's a link to my paper's Capital Confidential blog. You'll also find it at timesunion.com. As summer ends, New York's political class is beginning to ponder what the 2020 legislative session might bring. Also thinking about the opportunities is newly installed State Bar President Hank Greenberg. We sat down with a veteran lawyer at the Bar Association's headquarters earlier this month. Hank Greenberg, thanks so much for taking the time. We really appreciate it. So Bar Association presidents serve a one-year term, correct?
Correct.
And you have an agenda, kind of a four-point agenda, that one imagines it. You could spend many more years, at least four, on that. So let's kind of take them one by one.
Sure.
You think that the Bar Association needs to do more to press for legislation covering autonomous vehicles, the growth of autonomous vehicles in the state.
So we've created a task force that is going to study the legal dimensions of autonomous cars. To your question, not to presume what the task force is ultimately going to recommend, but this much, Casey, we know to a certainty. Autonomous cars are coming. Mm-hmm. This is not like electric cars in the 70s and 80s where we thought they were, but they weren't. The auto industry has made absolutely clear that through their investments that autonomous cars will be here. We know the technology is getting closer and closer to actually being able to put them on the road. So we know that autonomous cars will be regulated. There will be statutes, there will be regulations. We're not going to wake up one morning on a thruway and see 16-wheel trucks driving by us on both sides with no one at the wheel without there being laws to sort of govern and assure safety. To assure data protection and privacy rights for people who own these cars. So we know these things are going to be happening. We know there's going to be regulation, and what we want to do for policymakers through a blue ribbon commission, the best and the brightest, the smartest minds, to make a proposal or a set of recommendations about what that regulatory scheme should look like. And we are hopeful that we will see those recommendations by April of 2020, and I think they'll be helpful for policymakers.
You also believe that the association has a role to play in parole reform.
We do. As you know, there's been considerable debate in the legislature with respect to parole reform. I think there's a consensus that the parole system does need improvement. Our most available data is in 2016. Nearly a third of reincarcerated persons in our correctional system are people who were sent there because of technical violations of the terms of parole. We are an outlier as compared to other states in that respect. And the legislature has been looking at this issue closely and hasn't been able to come to consensus on it. What we've done to try to fill that vacuum, or at least help the process, is put together another Blue Ribbon Task Force, an incredibly diverse task force in every respect, including ideologically. It's made up of district attorneys, defense lawyers, victims' rights advocates, academics. And the idea is that if a group of such distinguished and diverse persons can come to consensus on some of these issues, which are controversial, that will help the legislature ultimately be able to pass some laws that I think we all recognize are needed to reform the system.
There's been considerable pushback, of course, from Republicans to many of the other criminal justice reform efforts that were passed in the 2019 session, things like decriminalization, what have you. Do you think that that is unfinished business, that the Bar Association's kind of assistance or counsel could put that on the table again for 2020?
Well, we always stand ready to be helpful and supportive of the legislature. We were created by the legislature in 1876 by a legislative enactment. And it's our mission and our purpose to try to be able to be of assistance and to be a resource for policymakers. And so if we were called on to look at issues with respect to the criminal justice system, we stand ready to be helpful. Our current focus, though, at least going into this legislative session, is the parole system.
You also think that the association has a role to play in addressing a subject that is really affecting many communities upstate, and that's the dearth of attorneys in rural areas, that many of them are essentially aging out of practice or can no longer remain in business.
It's a coming crisis. The rights the citizenry takes for granted and assumes it has can only be enforced if there are lawyers and judges in a position to champion and enforce those rights. In broad swaths of upstate New York, large parts of the state are rural, North Country, parts of the Mid-Hudson area, the southern tier, throughout the state, there are areas that are not heavily populated. And increasingly, lawyers are not either moving to these communities or alternatively, they're reaching retirement age. More than half of lawyers in rural communities in New York State are at or near retirement age. 75% of the lawyers practicing in these communities are 45 or older. Young lawyers are not going to these communities to replace them. The consequence of upstate New York not having legal support, having lawyers and judges in sufficient numbers, rights don't get enforced, and the citizenry is disadvantaged. There are lots of reasons why this is occurring, and there are lots of barriers to practice in those areas. There isn't enough broadband access in those communities. The rates that the state currently pays lawyers who represent indigent persons are way too low, making it harder and harder to encourage lawyers to take on that representation. This is a serious issue, and there are pockets of the state where we do have a justice crisis. So again, we hope to propose recommendations of statutory change or regulatory change that could be helpful.
It's analogous to the problems these rural areas have faced, not just in upstate New York, but across the country in terms of medical help as well, where doctors, private practice doctors are aging out, you know, young doctors can't see a way to, you know, to afford to practice in those areas. I mean, there have been ideas proposed for economic incentives to put doctors in these communities. Is there something that you think can be done? You mentioned the reimbursement rates that could get young lawyers into these communities as well.
Well, many young lawyers, like many professionals and many people graduating college and professional schools, are just swamped with debt. Mm-hmm. Hundreds of thousands of dollars in some cases. So the relatively smaller salaries that doctors would be paid or lawyers would be paid in these upstate communities, coupled with the debt, is a toxic combination and a disincentive for them to make their lives and careers in those communities. So there have been debt forgiveness programs for attorneys in the public service realm. I think thought should be given as well to debt forgiveness for people who are willing to spend their professional life or a portion of it in these communities.
It's a similar problem in many ways in the fourth agenda item you have for your term, which is looking at the problem facing local journalism in many of those same communities. You believe that the association has a role to play in suggesting ideas for addressing kind of the crisis, the economic crisis that is facing journalism.
Again, another crisis. It's increasingly challenging, particularly for print media in many upstate communities, and not just rural communities, in small cities as well, to have sufficient resources to provide a staff. Technology, the digital revolution, digital advertising is making it harder and harder for newspapers in the capital region around the state, upstate and downstate, to be successful. This has an immediate impact on the law in addition to the citizenry in a couple of different ways. If we don't have a vigorous, independent press in upstate communities or in smaller communities, who's going to be the watchdog for local government? If we don't have a vigorous and robust journalism throughout the state, that impacts First Amendment values and free expression values. So once again, we have assembled a Blue Ribbon Commission. This one is co-chaired by the Deputy General Counsel of the New York Times. They're going to do a deep dive. They're going to hold hearings all around the state, try to get as much input as they possibly can from people in the media and others, and come back with a set of proposals, hopefully that can ameliorate the problem.
Along with that agenda, you've also recently taken on another project, and that's serving as one of the editors on a collection of the writings of Chief Judge Judith Kaye. You clerked for Judith Kaye in the late 1980s. You've been a friend of hers until her death only a couple of years ago. If you were describing her to a young attorney just entering the practice, how would you sum her up?
The best of the best. A perfect combination of brilliance, practicality, compassion. New York State, in its history, has not had a finer public servant or a more devoted one than Judith Kaye. An extraordinary person, extraordinary life story, larger-than-life figure. And I would say to any young lawyer who's interested in a career in public service and wants to know what the potential is to help people, to do the public good, look at the life and legacy of Judith Kaye. She's an inspiration.
The book is unique in that it includes admiring essays about her career from the people who worked with her and knew her. It includes a significant section that's her own memoir about her life and career. And then it's given over to many of her opinions, which right. range from the very technical, you know, to the really sweeping. And I think one of her most revered decisions is probably in Hernandez v. Robles, which is her dissent in a 2006 case touching upon same-sex marriage.
It's ironic. She was not the great dissenter. As Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals, she was an enormous and persuasive force. She was almost always in the majority. She did dissent from time to time when she thought it was important. The Hernandez case was one of those moments. The court was faced with the question of whether or not same-sex marriage was a constitutional right. A majority of the court said no. She felt strongly that it was, and she wrote one of her most powerful and passionate and eloquent defenses. You know, an interesting thing about Judith Kaye, brilliant, humane, a great legal thinker. She was also an exquisite writer. She was a journalist, Casey. She started her career with the aspiration of being a professional journalist, and she found when she did that, you know, because she was a woman at the time she aspired to do it, there weren't the opportunities. That led her in part to go to law school. But, you know, Hernandez is not just powerful, it's poetry. And it is one of her great writings. There were many. She wrote over 600 writings, majority opinions, concurrences, dissents, many of them landmarks. But I expect your question is right. She will be remembered for, among other things, for writing that dissent, which helped inspire the legislature to get around to pass the law and make it a statutory right in New York.
Robles closes by noting that the court will look back on its majority decision shooting down same-sex marriage a generation later with regret. In fact, it only took less than a decade
right.
before nationally this issue was settled.
Right. Well, the velocity of change in that area, particularly for the law, was stunning. But her dissent, I think, helped in a way that is rare, Anyone who writes a dissent is usually thinking about the future or hoping someone in the future would see the wisdom of what they were arguing for. But the dissent was so powerful that I think it helped move the legislature in part to see the wisdom of finally securing a statutory right to same-sex marriage.
All right. Well, Hank Greenberg, thanks a lot for taking the time. Fascinating stuff. We really appreciate it.
Casey, thank you so much for doing this.
All right. That was a really interesting interview, Casey, and I guess it's never too early to start thinking about legislation for autonomous cars.
Yeah, it's not something you would expect the Bar Association to be into, but of course the law covers pretty much every aspect of our lives. If folks found that interview interesting, I recommend going online. You can hear a snippet that we weren't able to include in the broadcast version, where Hank Greenberg talks about an episode, his research into a historical episode from a century ago, where the Bar Association, in particular Charles Evans Hughes, stood up against political intolerance right here in Albany.
It comes out as the same week as the Alabama Republican Party recommended expulsion for Congresswoman Ilhan Omar in Minnesota.
Yeah, everything old is new again, unfortunately.
Hi, everyone. I'm Matt Ryan. If you like what you hear, rate and review us right on your mobile device. When you do so, it makes it a little easier for people trying to find us. And thanks so much for listening to the New York Now podcast.